This is Attack of the 20th Century. Thank you for joining us as we explore science fiction, fantasy, and horror films of the 20th century. I am your host, Jeff.
And I am your other host, Kim.
Welcome to episode 9, where we review 1963's Jason and the Argonauts. Make sure you look for us on Instagram and Facebook at Attack of the 20th Century, that's 20th. We post our next movie selections there. You can comment, give your thoughts, and they just might make it on the air. This last week, we watched Tom and Jerry when it first came out on Friday. No, we watched it on Saturday.
I'll go with that. You'll Saturday, go with that? A day well, in the past week, we watched it.
Yeah, it's kind of been a blur for us this last week.
It's been a busy week.
But yeah, Tom and Jerry, it came out. We watched it. It was funny. The whole family.
Oh, yeah. I think our youngest particularly loved it. Yeah, he loved that good Tom and Jerry. He's been waiting for this movie to come out. This is his speed.
We actually paid for an extra month of HBO Max.
Just so we could catch this movie. That's right. I forgot about that. So he loved it. It was all right. I mean,
Kind of disposable fun.
Yeah, yeah. I'm happy that the 9-year-old was happy with it.
Yeah.
So... There you go.
I was pleased with it.
I will say I maybe had my hopes set on there being some really funny Michael Pena interactions there because he's so hilarious and like Ant-Man.
Yeah.
And I don't know. He wasn't even really likable in this movie, I didn't think. Like, there's a few humorous jabs he gets in there in this movie, but...
I don't know if it's the writing for him or what, but I felt the same way when we watched Dora the Explorer because he plays Dora's dad. And he's just kind of there. It's a little flat. He says things that I think it should be funny, but you're like, well, that's not really funny, though.
Right.
And so I don't know if the writing for him is just perfect for Ant-Man.
I don't know. I really, really enjoy him in Ant-Man.
Yeah.
Both Ant-Man movies. So I don't know. I don't know. Interesting. Yeah.
It felt like he should have been funnier. but
I agree.
Overall, the movie, you know, it was good. I watched the old Tom and Jerry cartoons with our kids maybe a year ago.
Right.
And they are just so funny.
Yeah.
They're so much funnier than the movie.
Yeah. And whatever my parents have, whatever streaming services they have, I think every time our youngest goes over there, he is always watching Tom and Jerry at their house. He just loves Tom and Jerry. So for that, I like it.
Yeah. I did have something fun for us to do today before we get into our movie. So there's this new John Goodman series of commercials I'm sure you've seen.
Oh, yes.
Slotomania. They're basically slot machine advertisements for,
What it is? Like an online gambling something?
That's what I think it is.
I literally have not. I've seen this commercial you're talking about, but I like instantly mute the television or turn away. I know it comes on regularly between Wheel of Fortune and Jeopardy because... Mm-hmm. What you may not know is that I try to watch at least Jeopardy every night.
Yeah.
Often I will catch Wheel of Fortune also, but Jeopardy is my love language, maybe? I don't know. I love Jeopardy. And I know that this annoying commercial comes on somewhere between Wheel of Fortune and Jeopardy.
Yeah. Well, it's a really freaky commercial. Very weird. A couple months ago, me and the kids were in a pizza place and this commercial came on. And it led me to ask a question of our kids that I'm going to ask you tonight.
Oh, boy.
If you had... So, in this commercial, let me back up.
Yeah, yeah.
John Goodman is on somebody's finger. And he's like a flying finger, but it's like the tip of the finger, instead of being a fingertip, is the head of John Goodman.
Yeah, his face is on someone's finger.
And it's like talking. It has a personality. But it's on,
weird.
It's on an appendage.
That's really weird.
But it led me to this question. Let's say you have four fingers, right?
Sure.
On one hand, what four people would you have on your hand? And then we got into this whole, like, why would you do that? And I said, well, all right, well, look at it this way. A genie shows up and says,
I need to preface this for listeners. Jeff always has these outlandish questions he poses to the family, and we have to come up with answers. And when we look at him like he's gone nuts, he has a backstory. Somehow, instantaneously has a backstory he fills in. So you may proceed with your genie story, sir.
So yeah, a genie shows up and says, look, your fingertips are going to become four different people on, you know, one person on each fingertip. And It's going to have their likeness of them in their prime, you know, so you can kind of pick in their prime. Like, it's not going to be like a skeleton that's talking to you because the person that you pick is dead.
Okay. Okay. Thank you for clarifying.
And, you know, if you say, well, I want my fingers, I don't care. You know, I don't want to do this little thing.
Yeah, I don't want faces on my fingertips.
But that's how I always make people play, is I come up with something awful because they're a genie, right? And so the genie's like, if you don't pick anybody, I'm going to pick four Nazis and stick them on your fingers. And they're going to be making your life very uncomfortable for you.
Wait, so if I had four Nazis on my fingertips, could I just like spend my day slamming my fingers in car doors or something? Like,
that sounds pretty terrible.
Yeah, that sounds terrible for all of us involved. Never mind.
But yeah, I mean, you know, they would be shouting obscenities, slurs, just all these terrible things that make
your
life
Can they speak loud enough that other people can hear them? Or can I? Oh, so not just me.
Not just you.
Okay. Okay. That's a problem.
So that's a problem. So you have to pick four people that you want to hear their voices. And
I won't be embarrassed if other people hear their voices.
Exactly.
Fantastic.
So they'll have independent thought. They'll have their own, obviously, their personalities, their own thoughts, their own speech.
Do they go to sleep ever, or are they just talking all the time? Do they take turns talking, or are they talking over one another?
When you sleep, they'll go to sleep.
Great.
And they'll talk, they'll argue amongst each other, I'm sure, depending on who you pick.
Hmm.
And you can't cheat and pick four mutes. So what four people would you have on your hand? And I'll go ahead and... you want to do one at a time? Like me do one and you do
one? Sure, because that'll buy me time to think, maybe.
Okay. Well, I'll start with a personal hero of mine, Mr. Rod Serling.
Of course, yes.
Creator of the Twilight Zone. But he's highly intellectual, extremely creative. He seems like he knows how to handle himself in any situation.
He's got a pretty great voice, too.
Great voice, incredible vocabulary.
Mm-hmm.
And he seems like the kind of guy that I would love just kind of having around, I could bounce things off of.
Sure, yeah.
And he's got a great mind for character study, right?
Oh, yeah.
So he could kind of give me an edge, you know, like in business and that kind of thing.
Oh, gotcha.
Jeff, this guy's lying to you.
in the Twilight Zone.
Yeah, yeah.
Did he get into politics at some point?
No. No, his politics came out through his writing.
Oh, okay. So there were political ideas and thought.
Oh, yeah.
In his pieces. That I remember. Yeah. Maybe I was associating that with actual involvement in politics.
Originally, he tried to write about civil rights and things like that, and it kind of fell flat.
Oh.
But then he said, it was amazing, you know, I did these same thoughts and same ideas, but I put them in the mouth of an alien.
Yes, so true.
And suddenly everybody wanted to hear it.
Ah, oh, wow, what a smart play on his part. That's really cool.
So that's my number one.
Okay, so your number one. So these have to be like real humans that have existed. We're not doing fictional characters?
Yeah, you can't do like George Jetson.
Okay. Oh, well, cartoon fingers might be cuter.
They would be cuter, but that's not the genie. You know, remember, he's like, hey, you want a Hitler on your finger?
Okay, I don't want a Hitler on my finger. Maybe my middle finger. No, no. Okay, oh gosh, you really put me on the spot here, Hanshaw. All right, so I'm going to go with Madeline L'Engle.
Oh.
All right.
Author.
Yes, author of Wrinkle in Time and all those books. I personally love her for her nonfiction writing.
Mm-hmm.
I've read several of her books, like Circle of Quiet and those in her. They're almost like sort of memoir-ish written. I just made that word up. But
memoir-ish?
Yeah.
It's kind of hard to say, too.
Just go with it. It works. Yeah, it's a hard word to say.
Yeah, it is.
But I don't know. Like, I always kind of resonated with her. She kind of felt awkward in her own skin, but was super intellectual, and maybe I wanted to resonate with her anyhow. She's a very intellectual, deep thinker, but a very calm, cool, collected personality that just was a keen observer of the world. So
okay. So when you get a little spirited or a little, your feathers get ruffled, she could
invite me into her circle of quiet, because that's her favorite book of mine.
I was trying to think of some nice way of saying it.
Okay, nice.
Well, yes. Good pick. My next pick is my favorite Beatle to listen to, like in interviews, because I love his quiet calm of his voice and that's George Harrison.
Oh, yes.
He was considered the quiet Beatle, but he seems very wise. You know, I'm just a huge Beatle fan anyway, and I love all four of them. He really seems to be that introspective, cerebral kind, very in touch with his feelings as well, though.
Oh, yeah.
You know? And I know he was quite the philosopher, so I don't know. Right. I think he would be a good one to have in your corner with you and Rod Serling.
Some interesting conversations there, for sure.
And then I like to hear him sing, too. I think it would be cool to sing along with George occasionally, have him do some harmonies with me while I play and sing.
True.
Yeah, I would say George Harrison's my number two. What about you?
Oh, my goodness. I don't know. Gosh, I feel like I should pick a musician now. Who do I love to listen to? Well, Johnny Cash would just be fun. If I'm going with a musician, like, he might get me in a little bit of trouble. Well, not in his older years. You know, he calmed down. So I don't know if I'm going young, rebel Johnny Cash.
You get to pick.
Man in Black, or if I'm going older, chill Johnny Cash. I mean, I enjoy his voice more, his singing voice more when he's younger.
Right.
And I think that would be quite a study in opposites to have him perched next to Madeline L'Engle. So I'm going to go with the young Johnny Cash. Why not?
It's kind of a social experiment, too.
Yeah, right? I mean, if you're making me have people on my fingers, let's just go wild.
All right. Well, my third is a minister named Alistair Begg.
Oh, yes, Alistair Begg.
He would be my spiritual advisor. He'd be the one that would keep me on the straight and narrow, hopefully.
Yeah.
But if you've ever heard Alistair Begg, he sounds like a young Ewan McGregor.
Yes. He's Scottish.
He's very much Scottish, but he has such a quiet, calming voice.
Yeah, too. It is very calming.
Like I said, he seems extremely wise and somebody that I could bounce things off of as well. You know, we could collaborate on what's the right thing to do here.
Very true. All right, so you went in the direction of a spiritual advisor. I'm going to take that and I'm going to try and get a 2-for-1 here and go with C.S. Lewis.
Ooh.
Because we've got great writing, great conversationalist. I don't really know what his voice sounds like. I'm sure there are recordings out there that I've heard of him, but I can't picture it. British accent, I'm sure, right? Mm-hmm. I love a British accent. So, but also very grounded, just has studied and written so much about the Christian faith. Super wise guy.
Yeah.
And super creative. I mean, he's got all of his Narnia series. And actually, my 10th graders right now are starting to read Out of the Silent Planet, which is, he has a sci-fi trilogy too. So he checks a lot of boxes there. So
yeah. Well,
I'm going to go with C.S. Lewis. Why not?
That's pretty good. Well, for my final pick, because I don't want to have like a sexist hand or a misogynist hand.
I just don't like the sound of either of those terms at all. Wow.
I feel like I need to have a female on my one of my fingers. And
I'm wait, all, yeah, but she's going to be all by herself. You've got three dudes and one girl. Okay.
Well, you know, some right. representation there at least. I don't know.
Sure.
I'm going to go with Norah Jones.
Good choice.
I love to hear her sing. She's got, again, I love a quiet, calm type of voice. And she has it. And I thought, too, of the possibilities of her with George Harrison singing together. I thought, that would be really cool. Yeah.
Sure, I'd like to hear that.
They could sing a duet for me while I go to sleep each night.
So if you have four people on your hand and I have four people on my hand, our bed has just gone from two people to 10?
10. That's a lot.
I was a little slow on that math. That's been a long day.
Yeah. At least you didn't use your fingers to count
those
out.
I hope none of these people are snorers.
Ugh. Yeah, I didn't even think about that.
Yeah.
But
your little social experiment's gone awry.
I think Norah Jones would be a good one too to have. You know, like, what gifts do you think Kim would like for her birthday or for Christmas? She could.
I trust Norah Jones' taste.
Yeah,
I'd appreciate that.
I think, you know, women are probably more wise about what other women like. A lot of times I'm shooting from the hip when it comes to gifts and stuff. So I think
she
might be able to help me there and give me some advice on like date nights and things like that. What would be well received by my wife?
Sure. All right. I am
It's your last pick.
Trying to solve an argument in my head right now. So I can go with probably my favorite author of all time. I'll throw another female in the hand here, which would be Jane Austen. But I just had this fleeting thought. I've stumbled recently, thanks to some dear friends, have pointed me in the direction. I have an Instagram account, but I've stepped away from it for a long time. I don't love social media, right? But recently, my friends are like, "You have to check this lady out. You'll love her. She's amazing." So I'm gonna plug another, I'm gonna plug a social media Instagrammer here, and it's Sharon Says So. So if you're on Instagram, go check out Sharon Says So. I think she might be. Is it a toss up between her and Jane Austen? That seems so random because this lady's like alive right now.
Yeah.
And probably never going to hear this podcast, but she's brilliant.
We could feature her in our Feature Friday.
Okay, maybe. I don't know what
she is. Give her some good press.
Okay, so let me say what her Instagram account is all about.
Okay, tell us what
because
it's about.
It doesn't really go with Attack of the 20th Century, but she has been a government teacher of high schoolers for years and years.
Uh-huh.
She seems, I'm a newbie follower to this lady, but super down to earth, super chill. Answers anybody's questions. Like if you want to follow politics and understand what's going on with the US government and our shenanigans with other governments and voting and Supreme Court cases, all of that stuff, like you can ask her literally any question and she gives you just the facts. She points you to primary documents to help you research things on your own. She's completely unbiased in the information she puts out there. And she literally is just educating the general public of Instagram on what goes on in American government. And she'll explain it to you. Like you can literally ask her a question and say, explain blank to me like I'm a 5-year-old. And she makes it like in the clearest terms. And you know, I love learning. I'm a big geek like that. So I just love it. I love the way she presents her information. Well, and I'm kind of fangirling right now on Sharon Says So. So there you go. She gets today.
Yeah.
She gets a spot on my finger spot. What?
Well,
why is this even a thing?
It sounds all right. I mean, you know, if I get insomnia, maybe I could ask her a question, let her keep talking.
She has a very soothing voice, too. Like, I mean, she definitely, I think she's in maybe Minneapolis area somewhere. So very much that Midwestern.
Oh, okay.
Kind of, not a super heavy accent, but you can hear it. But it's a very calm, she's just very chill and she doesn't take herself too seriously. I think she'd be enjoyable to have a conversation with.
Okay.
I don't know that she wants to live on my fingertip for the rest of her life. That's going to make her Instagram life.
That's not your fault. That's the genie's fault.
Okay.
Blame it on the genie. Jason and the Argonauts was released June 19th, 1963. It was directed by Don Chaffee, though it's more well known for its special effects director, Ray Harryhausen, and his stop motion effects.
That's right. So we're going to talk about Jason and the Argonauts. Just remember that we do talk spoilers here. So if you haven't seen it, pause us, go find Jason and the Argonauts, give it a watch, and come back and join us later. Jason and the Argonauts is rated G.
Nice.
And it's fun for the whole family. So it's Greek mythology. We're looking at one of these great Greek heroes. He's was born to rule over his father's kingdom, but as a baby, his father gets murdered and his kingdom taken over by evil Pelias. So Jason has to go off and grow up on his own, and then he grows up and decides, I need to avenge my father's death and take back over his kingdom. So when we meet Jason, we kind of zoom out and we're up on Mount Olympus with the Greek gods, right? And they're kind of, I don't know, it's almost like they're playing with people like we're a chess match or something, right?
Right.
So Hera decides she's taken a liking to Jason and she wants to help Jason out. She knows Jason's got these big goals to retake his father's kingdom. And Zeus is kind of like, I don't know, like you can't go messing around here too much. I've got plans, blah, blah, blah. But Hera, so he gives Hera permission to help Jason 5 times.
Right.
So we go on this big adventure with Jason. He's got to go out to sea. He's got to go find the Golden Fleece. Mm-hmm. He's got to get together a ship and a crew and basically do these tasks, kind of Herculean tasks, if you will, to be able to get this Golden Fleece and come back and win his dad's kingdom back.
That's right. Hey, you did good. That was less than 2 minutes.
Yeah, was that less than 2 minutes? All right. So
fantastic.
There we go. That's our jumping off point for this movie.
Yeah. Well, I don't remember seeing this movie as a kid, other than like little spots of the movie, right? It's like,
yeah.
I remember Hera's head, you know, on the ship, the eyes opening.
Right, yeah.
And the voice talking quietly. So I remember bits and pieces like that, but they kind of blend together with the other fantasy movies that were on Saturday sure. afternoons. And for me, the first time I saw this movie end to end is when we had kids. And we were looking for things to watch together besides cartoons.
Yeah.
And if you remember, that's when we broke out Doctor Who.
Yeah.
Like, I started thinking about, like, what did we used to watch when we were kids other than these annoying cartoons that our kids were watching?
Yeah.
And we went back and we found out, oh, Doctor Who, look at that. They have a new take on Doctor Who. And then we started from the beginning and worked our way through Doctor Who. And
yeah,
but with our kids, we were watching some of the classic Doctor Who together. And
yeah, the old stuff.
The old stuff. But then that opened this door to all these old Ray Harryhausen monster movies.
Yeah.
Because like Kim mentioned, there this one, for instance, was rated G. I mean, there's really nothing objectionable. And there's some...
Wasn't one of our kids scared of the skeletons at one point, though?
You know, that is a good point. It seems
I think
like,
our youngest maybe had issues with the skeleton army that comes at towards the very end of the movie.
Yeah.
But
he was really young, though.
Yeah, he was really young then.
He's
they don't
nine
bother
now,
him
and he doesn't mind the skeletons. But yeah, I mean, so that was my first time seeing it at some point then. And then we've watched this movie as a family over and over again. Because if you have kids, you know, kids like to watch things over and over
yep.
again. So we've seen this one probably 10 times in... since we've had kids.
So same for me. I think I don't remember watching it end to end as a kid, but I know I probably did, because it's definitely one of those things. We were talking about this on Saturday afternoons, like TNT or TBS or somewhere. They'd have these old movies would just play.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was something you'd come in. You know, we live in Florida. It gets really hot in the summer. So usually in the afternoon you're in looking for a movie to watch, right?
Yeah.
So it's definitely, I had seen most of it on multiple occasions as a kid. My dad would, you know, stumble upon an old movie and let it play and we'd watch parts of it or whatever. So
mm-hmm.
It's just fun. It's a great fantasy adventure flick. And yeah, since like you said, I mean, I have the same exact story.
Yeah.
Once our kids, you know, we got tired of watching reruns of Caillou and I don't know. Thomas or something.
Ugh.
I don't know. I like Thomas. Thomas yeah. was good.
I look back at them fondly now because of our kids were young. But
sure.
When you're in the thick of it, you're like, oh my gosh, we're watching this again.
Yeah. So we're like, let us introduce you to something more interesting. And we did.
We did. Yay. Well, now's a segment that we call High Fives and Low Points, and I'm going to get us started with my first high five, and that high five for Jason and the Argonauts has to go to Ray Harryhausen.
For sure.
Special effects guru, bringing these monsters to life that had never, you know, there was no CGI, there was nothing like that.
Right.
And to put something that's physical, a real creation, a physical form of material, and to have that monster fighting people, it's outstanding. Like, it's just fun. It just brings the kid out of you, you know, the fantasy aspect.
Right.
Stirs something in you, I think, to see that.
For sure. And it ages so well.
Yeah.
Like, computer-generated graphics just, you know, you can almost pinpoint to the year what decade and mm-hmm. what year they come out of when you see them in a movie. And,
oh, yeah.
And obviously, you know, this is an older movie. When you watch it, you can tell, okay, this is coming out of the 60s or whatever. But it just holds its classicness, you
mm-hmm.
know, that, I don't know, they just really age well, this whole stop motion, practical monsters. They're
yeah.
very cool.
So that has to bring us to the question, I mean, of these monsters, what was your favorite of the ones that we saw in this film?
Oh, Talos is, I think, hands down my favorite. I love that he's a bronze statue on an island of giant bronze statues. And he does everything. If a bronze statue really came to life, he's doing the things. I mean, he has that kind of mechanical motion to his movements.
Mm-hmm.
And he has the creaking. He creaks
yeah.
like he has metal joints,
yes.
you know? And I even like, and I know it harkens back to the original Greek myth, but I love the way they, you know, I don't know if kill him or do away with him is basically by loosening some screw or something down by his heel or breaking off a little, it was almost like a patched hole they opened up. And
yeah,
I don't know what was coming out of him that made him meet his demise, but it looked like some sort of oil mechanical, you know, if you were a giant bronze statue, what would you need in you? You're like the Tin Man, right? You've got to oil your joints or something.
Yeah.
So it looked like the right substance that should have come out of, you know, a dying animated bronze statue. I just love him. I think he's so cool.
He is cool. I hate that scene when he's dying, though, and he's like grasping at his throat.
Oh, I know.
I'm like, you know, Talos didn't do anything wrong here.
He was guarding his island with jewels, you know.
He's guarding the jewels of the gods.
Right.
And these guys come do something they're not supposed to, and he gets killed.
Yeah, they were warned, like, don't mess with the stuff. Don't take any of the jewels. That's the gods' jewels.
Yeah.
You know, but did they listen? Hercules and Hylas, they had to go in there and mess around.
I know.
Hercules needed that brooch pin that looked like, it was so big, it looked like a spear to him.
Yeah.
Talos.
Talos is definitely the coolest. He was my favorite as well. But, I mean, there's definitely some good ones. The Hydra is really cool.
Yeah. Harryhausen is the master. I mean, he set the stage for all future monsters. Like, he was the guy who set the bar, so.
Yeah.
Kudos to him. He's cool.
Something else that's cool about Ray Harryhausen is the effect that he's had on modern-day filmmakers. You know, you look at Steven Spielberg, Peter Jackson, Tim Burton. I know if you watched on YouTube, there's tons of stuff with John Landis. He was a major fan of Harryhausen. But, you know, you even look at the... what's Monsters, Inc.? What, Pixar?
Yeah, Pixar.
Yeah, they have the restaurant called the Harryhausen.
Yes, yes. Yeah. I loved that when we watched Monsters, Inc. for the first time. I was like, Ray Harryhausen, you know.
And I've seen a lot of things on YouTube where people are talking about, you know, modern day special effects people. Even though they're doing computer animated stuff, they're saying, we need some more Harryhausen here.
Right.
Because you think these stop motion characters, they had life. They had a characteristic to them.
Yeah.
They definitely seemed organic. They seemed like their own thing.
Right.
But still animal-like. And I think that's what's kind of cool about it. You know, the animal thing, I think a human stop-motion thing doesn't look as good as something that's more of an animal that doesn't have quite the same thought process. Mm-hmm. But, you know, that they just have this whole life of their own. It's really a testament to him that modern-day people, even though they're doing all this sophisticated computer stuff, are trying to make it look like... Just,
you know,
stop-motion characters. Beyond.
They're still... Yeah, exactly. They're still hearkening back to what he was doing.
Mm-hmm.
And he wasn't just like the special effects guy. I mean, I know that was his title, but he had a hand in casting and a hand in scene writing, didn't he?
Mm-hmm.
Because it was his, you know, what he wanted in Hercules that got, who's the guy who played Hercules?
Nigel Green.
Yeah, Nigel Green. I'm pretty sure he's the guy who got him cast because he didn't want to go with the stereotypical muscle man Italian actor, you know, like he wanted a more believable kind of everyman's Hercules. Mm-hmm. And so apparently was well respected, not just for his monsters, because they're letting him really kind of lead the way in casting and then in the fight scenes, kind of writing the scenes.
Mm-hmm.
Like Harryhausen knew what he was about. He was good at it.
Yeah, he directed those scenes. The actors talk about Ray would tell him where to keep their eyes in any of the scenes. And he would describe what they're fighting and try to get him in the moment.
Yeah.
But they were very precise with where to look with their eyes. And you and I were just talking about this
before. Yeah, that's one of my high fives, actually.
Go for it.
All right, so yeah, that's one of my high fives is the ability of the actors to fight with these non-CGI stop motion characters. It's so believable. They're so good.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm sure we can attribute this to Harryhausen from what you're saying now, is that they're so good at maintaining an eye contact. It's believable. We were just talking about, we watched the new Tom and Jerry movie with our kids. And I think it's one of my biggest complaints with that movie is it never once looked like the main actress made eye contact with Tom. Now I get it. He's an animated cat. Like that's hard.
Yeah.
But it was just, anytime there was interaction between a human and a cartoon character, it's like they missed the mark. They were never quite really making good eye contact. But you don't see that in a Ray Harryhausen.
No.
It really looks like your characters are fighting, you know, these whatever they are.
Yeah.
Stop motion monsters he's created out of, you know, rubber and molds and
yeah.
whatever. So I don't, yeah. how do they do that? What do they have? Someone holding a puppet in front of
a
the
crane.
Actor?
They said he used a giant crane and okay. would have things suspended from it and say it'd have a place for them to stare and he would move it around so they would all be looking at the same thing.
Oh, that's brilliant. Yeah.
And then he would just insert his creation there.
Wow.
You know, but it's just funny. Like you mentioned Tom and Jerry, I thought the same thing. It's like they're not really looking at each other.
Yeah,
it's clear
like they're
that,
always missing each other.
Yeah. And that's annoying. It's like, well, it's 2021. It seems like if they got it right
out.
In 1963, yeah. you could get it right in 2021.
Yeah, with a puppet on a crane or something, you know.
yeah.
I don't know. That's weird. But yeah, definitely it's believable, and I enjoy that about the Ray Harryhausen movies.
Mm-hmm. So my next high five has to be Nigel Green playing Hercules. You mentioned him before.
Yes.
He's definitely my favorite Hercules in any movie. You know, you and I have watched a ton of Hercules movies, being fans of Mystery Science Theater 3000.
Yes.
And Italian Hercules movies are traditionally made fun of pretty badly.
Yeah. What are the sword and sandals?
Sword and sandal flicks, yeah.
Yeah.
And these guys are all, you know, gigantic, muscle-bound, roided-up looking guys. And
right.
real stiff acting as well. And
oh, yeah.
But Nigel Green, when his first scene as Hercules, he even, like, rolls in on the sand in front of the, you know, Olympics that are going on.
yeah.
And all these other athletes.
Entrance.
Celebrate him, and it's just he's just cool and he's fun loving.
Yeah. And he's not like super young and buff either. Like he's
yeah.
buff, yeah, but he's got some age on him.
Mm-hmm.
But he's so charming. Like he's just kind of like that guy you want to have mm-hmm. along on your road trip, you know. He's just
oh,
fun.
Yeah.
Like
yeah.
he's gonna have a good time no matter where he is.
And he's a man's man, you know.
right.
Like you know, Jason's like, you know, you can't take anything from this island, you know, where they're right. going to see Talos. And he says something about if he finds any good looking women,
yeah.
you know, no man's going to stop him. And, you know, you're just like, all right, yeah, that's Hercules. But then this actor shows a different side, you know, when his friend dies. What was this? Hylas?
Hylas, yeah, that was like his sidekick.
When Hylas is suspected to be dead and has gone missing, you just see this somber attitude, and he realizes he messed up. Hercules
yeah.
messed up.
It's really his fault that Hylas is endangered.
Correct. And it's a totally different countenance to
mm-hmm.
his face. And I just thought that was good. You know, it shows both sides of this guy.
Yeah.
And a fullness to his character. One of the more animated folks in the movie.
Yes.
I really enjoyed Nigel Green as Hercules.
Yeah, very well-rounded and very likable. All right, so I'll throw out another actor, actress in this movie, and that is Honor Blackman as Hera.
Mm-hmm.
I really enjoyed her performance. I'm not a huge Bond fan, so
mm-hmm.
I didn't have all the knowledge, but you, of course, clued me in that
oh,
she
yeah.
is from, what,
Goldfinger? Yep.
Right. So I've heard lots of people talk about how they're really upset that she didn't get, like, third billing,
uh-huh.
or second or third billing, because we really, as females go in this movie, there's not a lot.
Right.
And we really see more of her, and she's more fleshed out, a more well-rounded character.
Uh-huh.
Than the younger actress that plays Medea,
uh-huh.
who ends up being Jason's love interest. But we don't even see Medea until maybe the last 30 minutes of the movie, whereas Hera
yeah.
is involved, you know, from the get-go. She
mm-hmm.
definitely has taken a liking to Jason, wants to help him out, is kind of pleading his case in front of Zeus, and she's allowed to give him, you know, little hints and tips, five of them, you
yeah.
know, throughout the course of his journey. I just thought she did a great job. She kind of has almost this slyness to her, you know, because,
uh-huh.
I mean, you know, Zeus is her husband and you're not pulling anything over on Zeus, but she
uh-huh.
kind of has to know how to work him, you know?
Right.
And she does that very subtly and very masterfully. So,
yeah.
I don't know, I really enjoyed her performance. And I know it's not her exactly, but when she's the masthead on the ship, like
yeah.
her eyes, whenever Jason looks at the masthead, her eyes pop open and she
mm-hmm.
can talk to him. It's just fun.
Yeah, that is fun.
Yeah, it's cool.
I'm totally with you. I didn't notice that she didn't have second or third billing. She definitely should have had second billing to Jason, I would say, in
yeah.
this one. She was great. I loved how she was a great foil for Zeus
And she really was.
Just, I mean, they're physically playing a game with people's lives.
Yeah. It's like they're playing chess with humans. Uh-huh. I mean, it's literally what they're doing up on Mount Olympus.
Just great acting, you know. And there's this moment that I just love because it kind of, it tears a little bit at you, you know, just kind of your emotional fabric when you're watching her, uh-huh. watching Jason kiss Medea at the
end. Yeah, at the end.
And then she makes a face of disappointment or of, you know, jealousy, hurt feelings.
Yeah. She's like, oh, maybe, you know, I do kind of like that kid.
Yeah. And all this time you
nobody
felt
else
like,
can have him.
Yeah. You know, this has been her pet project. She felt, you know, and I don't know if she wanted to be with him romantically or if it was more like what a mom would feel to see her son fall in love. And,
yeah, sure.
You know, I don't know what they were going for, but you could just... I just thought those little touches, when they throw in little things like that, mm-hmm. that's what makes people real, you know,
yeah, for
sure. in a film.
And it was very subtle. Like, you see her briefly, but it was so evident. She did a great job of acting that out on her face. It was, she didn't even say anything.
Yeah.
But we saw her face react to, you mm-hmm. know, that, what is that pool of water where basically she can see what's happening down on Earth.
Yeah.
You could see very clearly the range of emotions on her face mm-hmm. as she's watching Jason kiss Medea. So right. yeah, no, it was excellently played out.
Right. My next high five I'm going to give to Bernard Herrmann. Mm. If you've heard us review Vertigo, we went on and on about Bernard. We won't
Jeff
go
loves in... Bernard Herrmann.
Well, to me, it was just an epiphany that, wow, this guy's music has been a big part of my childhood.
So many movies and shows. Yeah. Yes.
Basically, all the biggies from Hitchcock. You know, North by Northwest stands out to me mm-hmm. as like one of his finest. And, you know, we talked about Vertigo. That music's classic. Obviously, Psycho is classic.
Right. Oh, yeah.
Well, you know, what really sells Greek fighters, you know, going yes. after these monsters, you know, with a warship, kind of a crazy scenario, yeah. mythical background. This music sells it.
But you notice there's no strings. There's like no strings. And there's a harp a few times when we're dealing with, I think, scenes with the gods or
Hermes.
Some little,
yeah,
oh,
Hermes
yeah, with Hermes. There's, yes, there's a little bit of harp in there, but it's all horns and brass. Yeah. And it's like bombastic because these are heroes are going on this journey. Yeah. It's just so kind of in your face.
Yeah.
Epic sounding.
It does sound epic.
Yeah, it's really... I mean, that's, I love the thought behind that. Like he yeah. purposely chose not to have, you know, stringy, whiny sounding instruments. He wants right. it to like punch you in the face. You
yeah.
know? Like these guys are getting on their ship and they're going to find this golden fleece, you know?
Yes.
I like that. Well, I'm going to give another high five to another actor, and that's Todd Armstrong as Jason. I really liked his acting too. You know, we get such little glimpses of most of the other actors in this movie. We're mostly dealing with Jason and Hera. And then, of course, Hercules gets a good spotlight for a portion of the movie.
Mm-hmm.
So Jason has to sell it. I mean, there's a lot riding on his shoulders. And I think he does a good job with it. You know,
yeah.
he's young, but he's not too young.
Right.
And he's optimistic, but he's realistic.
Mm-hmm.
I think he does a really good job of playing this out. And he's good looking, but he doesn't look like the pretty boy that is Pelias's son. You know,
yeah.
Pelias's son looks like a little too pretty and snotty. And,
yeah.
you know, he's used to getting his way. And Jason has this wholesome, robust, honest guy look to him. And I appreciate that.
So. Yeah. Yeah. He definitely had a good look. And he's confident and he's driven, but he's not like self-righteous or, you know, it
yeah.
doesn't rub you the wrong way.
Not cocky in an annoying way.
Yeah.
Yeah. yeah.
But yeah, you mentioned Gary Raymond that plays Acastus, the pretty boy guy.
Yes.
I think he does a great job, though, of making you not like him.
Oh, for sure. He's very good at being that, like, rich boy son, you know, like,
yeah.
he's just, or the king's son, just pampered and always gets his way, and just, ugh, you just don't like him.
Always planting the seeds of discontent with the crew,
yes,
saying things
he
like...
Yes, he always has some little sly remark to make, right when Jason's, like, given a directive. He's like, yeah. yeah, but...
Yeah.
You know.
And you see guys like that, you know, in my line of work in the business world, you know, you see people that try to undermine their manager from time
ugh.
To time. And they don't just come right out and say it, no, I won't do it. But they just throw in like, oh, don't worry, they won't listen anyway. You know, they throw
right.
out those things like little, that Acastus was saying.
Right, seeds of discontent. They're the Randalls.
Yeah.
You mentioned right. Monsters, Inc. earlier.
Right.
Let's come back to Monsters. They're the Randalls of the
yes.
crowd, right?
Yeah.
I don't like the Randalls.
But I could go on and on with the actors all getting high fives. The another one I'll give you is Pelias, Douglas Wilmer. Mm-hmm. You know, I just love that scene where he's like, Jason, be rest assured that no man fought harder than I did on the day that, you know, your father died.
Yeah. In the meantime, Jason has no idea this is the guy who actually killed his father, right?
It's like, well, he's being honest, I guess. Yeah, he's not getting lying.
His private joke in there. Nice. Yeah, no, he did a good job too.
And he's great in that he's like, he wants to keep his power.
Right.
So, you know, his pride isn't getting in the way, because a more prideful man would say, well, I can't stand this guy talking bad about me. I'm going to kill him.
Because remember,
the cast is like, father, you know, I'd forget what he says. Basically, why don't we kill this guy? And he says, well, if I do that, if I kill him, I'll kill myself.
Yeah, because he'd been warned.
He'd been warned by Hera.
Yeah.
So he had this cooked up this plan. I'm just going to send this guy on the other side of the world and I'll get to do my thing longer.
Yeah. And maybe something bad will befall him while he's on his little journey, right?
Get detained
and then
somehow.
He's out of my hands, but I didn't do it directly. So he can sidestep Hera's warning, basically.
Yes.
Yeah, that's pretty cool. Can I slide in a couple baby? They're not really baby high fives. These just popped in my head while we were talking. My first one would be the filming that we haven't really talked about. I love that there are some painted backgrounds in the movie, but so much of this is like legitimately filmed in a boat, on the water. They actually went to ancient Greek ruins, 5,000 year old, however old these things are. And they got permission from, I don't know, the Greek government to literally climb all over these ruins, throw nets over them.
Yeah, when they capture the harpies.
Yeah, and these are like, I mean, it's the real actors. I don't think it's stuntmen. Like they're legitimately climbing all over these columns and stones and catching harpies. I mean, they're not really catching harpies, obviously, but it just lends so much impressiveness to the film because it looks real
legit.
It is real. Yeah,
exactly.
So that's just nice because so many of the movies from the 60s, you're looking at a canvas, you know, or a set build or something. But when they're in the water, they're legitimately in the water. And when they're on the ruins of ancient Greece, they're actually on the ruins of ancient Greece. So that's impressive.
That is cool. You know, we talked about that while we were watching. It's like, those guys are really on a ship in the water.
Yeah.
I mean, there's definitely some models, like when they go through the clashing rocks, you know, the guy jumps up, Triton comes
up.
That's clearly a model. But the scenes where they're on a ship, like rowing and talking, you know, other movies in the period, would have been in a stage somewhere.
Right. And you'd had a painted ocean behind you.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
And so, there's just no beating the real thing.
No, it's really, really well done.
Another high five I'll throw out there is the representation of the gods. They really nail it, I think. You know, the spirit of the gods that we read about in classic mythology, who are very human in nature, conniving, very egotistical.
Right.
But there's something lovable and affable about them as well.
Right.
I love that scene with Zeus. You know, he's talking to little Jason. He's like, I offered him a ship and a crew to go with it, yet he refuses me. And everyone's like, harumph, harumph. Right. I just love it. You know, it wasn't wooden. I mean, I think the problem with so many of these older movies, especially ones that have kind of a fantasy bent to it, they're just so cheesy, you know, or the acting is really wooden. And even there's Ray Harryhausen films where he just wasn't nearly as fortunate with the casting as he is in this movie.
Yeah, very true. Very true. Yeah, so that was my last little high five that popped in my head was the historical accuracy. Well, I say historical, obviously it's all based on myth, so maybe we shouldn't say historical accuracy, mythological accuracy. So have a somewhat limited knowledge of Greek myths. I'm aware of them and who's who, you know, of the Greek gods and whatnot. But so I did a little digging just to see, like, how closely does this story actually follow the Greek myth of Jason and the Argonauts, and it's pretty close. I mean, there's a few liberties that were taken here and there, probably to help with the filming of things. Yeah. So I was impressed that they were able to stick so closely to the actual story of Jason and why he's going to get the Golden Fleece. I mean, pretty much, I mean, all the major details are there. So kudos to those guys. I love a movie that can closely follow the book. So I'm, you know, I say high five to these guys for sticking pretty close to the original myth here.
Yeah. They must have loved the original source material.
Yeah.
We've talked before, you know, the original Lord of the Rings trilogy. One reason why it's so well received, I think, is everybody that was part of the filming, Peter Jackson down to the set designers, were in love with the source material.
Right. Exactly.
And they really wanted to do right by the source material. And so I always think of that. You know, we used to watch documentaries on films like that. We still do, but we used to buy DVDs that had
that had documentary
that had the documentary
stuff in it,
like on the second DVD. And you know, but that was when I think of a great team or something where we're all coming together from different backgrounds, different walks of life to like go towards the same end goal.
Right.
I think of the Lord of the Rings trilogy.
It's best if you know your source material and you respect the source material. And obviously, it can't be, and there's room for artistic interpretation.
Sure.
And you're filming versus writing.
Right.
Like, there's just a whole difference in medium. So you're going to have to tweak some things.
Yeah.
But if the, you know, if the heart of it is there and the mainstays that need to be there, really helps the storytelling and helps those of us who care about things like that, too.
Well, I'll get us into low points. And there really isn't much to the low points of this film because, like Kim and I have talked about, we both love it. I mean, this is a fun flick.
It's just fun. Yeah, it's great.
But if there is one, that I think it's the most glaring of the two that we're going to mention here. And that is the love story seemed to be forced. We don't even see Medea until the last fourth of the movie. There's barely any on-screen time. I don't really get a sense of chemistry from them. Like when he saves her from drowning, obviously there's an attraction there, and that makes perfect sense. I mean, sailor at sea, and obviously she's gorgeous. Her hair is completely dry and done up too. And
yes, makeup perfect.
Yeah. But for her to give up everything that she knew and loved, her whole background, to sell out her people, steal the Golden Fleece, this great artifact of her people, and to run away with Jason. I don't know. It just didn't seem too believable that she was jumping in with both feet that quickly.
No, I agree. And I just, you know, I always say I have questions. So I have questions. Was Ray Harryhausen and Chaffee so sold on making this an adventure flick? They just, they knew they had to capture some love story in here. So it was almost an afterthought. Is that why it feels, you know, why it's really crammed in at the end? Or did they just not know what to do with it? And they wanted to focus on, you know, the skeleton army and the Hydra and the Talos, you know, giant bronze statue. Like, all of the emphasis are on these, you know, big the epic moments. The creations, the creatures, you know. I mean, that's what Harryhausen was known for. And that's obviously what we want to get into the movie as much as we can. So it's just like it was an afterthought. And I will say that's probably the biggest turn, you know, from the original mythology is is that Medea's character actually plays into the story much earlier in the original myth. And she's on much of the voyage with Jason and the crew. And even she is responsible, I believe, for
Talos.
Yeah, for the downfall of Talos originally. Like she,
but didn't she, wasn't she like a witch too? Like she has some magical powers.
Which they don't really zoom in the movie. She's kind of like the priestess. High priestess. Yeah. Of their, whatever their god was at
the three-headed thing.
Yeah. So they kind of leave it at that, but I think in the original myth, she's actually a witch, and she does some things to help Jason and the Argonauts throughout their journey, you know, and casts spells on things and tricks people.
Yeah.
And, you
they
know,
weren't quite ready for WandaVision or the Scarlet Witch back then.
No, I guess not. I guess not. They didn't. She was just meant to be a side character.
Yeah. And I don't know. I guess at some point, and then this is just me speculating, like, we need some women, you know, we need some sex appeal going on in this flick.
Right.
Because we meet her and then suddenly she's dressing down quite a bit and dancing in that celebration, I guess, to receive them. So they kind of turn up the sex appeal right then for that short bit of time.
Right.
But, you know, it's very quickly how sold she is on Jason.
I don't know much about Nancy Kovac, the actress, but they must have been banking that just her young, beautiful persona would draw people into the movie and had to kind of write it in somehow.
Yeah.
I mean, who knows? Maybe she was somebody's niece that's like funding the you know, the movie. I don't know.
But it's funny. We just recently saw her in the Bewitched opener. Remember we talked about, we just watched WandaVision and it's funny because we had just seen the Bewitched, the very first episode. And well, she plays Darren's ex-girlfriend.
Yes. I forgot all about that.
And she does, I think, much better job acting in that than she does here. She's really just not given much to do.
Well, I was going to say, there's not much to work with here. She just has to be smitten with Jason and willing to stick by him and do what he needs done, which isn't much, really. At that point, you've got 30 minutes left in the movie, so it's not a lot to do.
How would you fix this? And there's a couple things. One, you could just make the movie super long and do a little more development. What's really missing is them developing a relationship that's believable.
Right.
Okay, well, what's going to have a lady just kind of reject her people and run away with a guy? I need a little more than this. We need to have some more of those intimate moments where they're connecting.
Right.
And, you know, if you can't make the movie longer, you could cut out, which was our second low point, is the flying harpies.
Oh,
and,
yes.
You know, I mean, no offense to the flying harpies, but that whole thing with Patrick Troughton, who was amazing, by the way. We're big fans of Doctor Who. We love Patrick Troughton. He's great as Phineas.
Yeah.
But this little adventure that they have, it doesn't add a whole lot. You know, they could have cut it out.
Yeah, yeah. Really, the whole thing is just to squeeze in a few more Harryhausen monsters. And then to, I think in order to make the excuse for that, they gave Patrick Troughton, like, you know, he's going to tell them the next step they need to take to get to the Golden Fleece.
Right.
You know?
Whereas they could have given Jason six helps from Hera, and Hera just tell him the
same stuff. That's true. Yeah. The harpies were, they were just my least favorite monsters in this movie. As you know, they're still innovative and cool, but they were kind of spindly, and they almost look like
sickly
fairies, blue fairies.
Yeah.
I mean, they were like horrible, screechy things, but they look like their limbs would just snap like toothpicks.
Yeah.
You know?
It didn't seem like they were unbeatable.
They were like giant, annoying mosquitoes, not like terrifying creatures that, you know, basically came and stole Phineas's food every single day. I mean, don't get me wrong, they were annoying, but they weren't like terrifying monsters.
Yeah, it seems like somebody could have ganged up and, you know, been able to defeat them before the Argonauts got there. But
yeah, well, I guess maybe Phineas was all alone. Mm-hmm. Maybe that was part of his punishment. So
I thought there was another person or two they showed running around there. I
don't remember. I just remember Phineas being there. I'll have to go back and check that out.
But so, yeah, those are just suggestions, you know, we're going to give to these guys that, you know, obviously they've already made their movie. They've already made their fortune back on this film over time.
Took him a while, though. This was kind of one of Ray Harryhausen's first, like, you know, he's not a B movie that's playing second billing to something. This was like a
big budget.
This was a big budget, and it didn't do great originally. It certainly made its money back in the long run.
Yeah.
And then some. Like, it's become another one of those classics. Yeah. It seems that way that it, like, almost all these classics that have become beloved. Maybe they're not at first glance. They're kind of, you kind of have to learn to love them or see them, see beyond what they look like on the surface. We've talked about several movies that kind of fall into category.
I think movies that are memorable and innovative, they don't always make it as marketable films.
Right.
Or movies that just jump out and say, hey, folks, get your butts in the theaters and watch us right now.
Because
you know, there's something different about them. And different doesn't always translate to
money
right away.
Right.
Now, over time, though, people can say, hey, you know what? That really was pretty good stuff there.
Well, and of course, you don't know that someone's a masterful innovator in their technique until years down the road anyhow, right? Like, we didn't know that Ray Harryhausen's stop motion technique was going to basically change the movie industry until it'd been around a little while. So that's tough, too.
That is tough. As far as other actors, I mean, we've touched on just about each of them. Lawrence Naismith as Argus. I really like him. I use a quote from his all the time when, you know, Jason's talking about them grumbling.
Right.
And he just kind of says, like, sailors always grumble.
Yeah.
And just the way he says it, I mean, again, that's good acting. That's not just somebody saying a line. The way he says it is like, He really sells it, you know?
Right.
That's
right.
How he really feels. Well, great. Sailors always grumble.
Yeah. It's like, just this is life, Jason. You're going to have to put on your big boy pants and move on, right?
Yeah. But I use this all the time. You know, I've worked with a bunch of engineers, and, you know, engineers are always looking at problems and how to solve them. So they're always complaining. So I always say to myself, you know, engineers always grumble.
Yeah. Well, you can't take it personally, right? That's how they get through their job.
That's how they process, like, well, these are the improvements we need to make.
Yeah.
It's how they process it verbally, is just to complain and pick out the flaws. What about Hylas, the guy that dies being crushed by Talos? What did you think of him?
I like him. What I liked more, I like a good backstory. I found out that actor is John Kearney.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if I'm saying that right,
yeah.
But John Kearney and Nigel Green did not like each other at all when they started filming this movie.
Really?
Yes, I read this. So Nigel Green, who plays Hercules, he felt like John Kearney was too effeminate acting to play Hylas. Like, he was kind of a young whippersnapper and just, he wasn't that, you know, man's man kind of guy that Nigel Green is.
Yeah.
But they both, when they were filming the scene where they're stealing the jewels, basically, from the, you know, the bronze statue island, something happened. I don't know what it was, but they both got blinded. Some lighting snafu happened.
Oh, no.
Like, blinded so bad that they had to spend 2 weeks in an Italian hospital room together.
Yikes.
Having their eyes treated. Yeah, so I don't know what went wrong. I would like to know more about that story. Like, how do you get blinded on set like that?
Major
too much
laser
bronze?
Pointer?
Somebody... Do they have laser pointers then?
I don't think so.
It just worked out that they got stuck in this hospital room together for 2 weeks and ended up being like the best of friends. Like, you know,
that's a really cool story,
right? Like, that's just, I was like, okay, so I like these two even more.
Yeah.
Just knowing that, like, you know, that's just a good human story.
Yeah.
Where you have to get past the surface layers. Like, I have my assumptions about this person and he has his assumptions about me, but now we're stuck in a room together and we can ask real questions and realize, oh yeah, that's another human in that hospital bed over there, just like I'm a human in this hospital bed over here. So, so I like them more now that I know that story.
Yeah. I agree. I think he's a good foil for Hercules.
He is
a little on the effeminate side, but it's a good foil for the macho Hercules.
Yeah, Hercules is so larger than life. Like, it's nice. It's a good mix there, for sure.
And this guy is, you know, relies on his wits.
Yes,
you know?
He's the brains, really. Hercules is the bronze and Hylas is the brains.
Yeah.
Right?
All right. Well, final summations.
Well, I think it's obvious. It's a yay for me. Like, I just like this movie. It's a fun, nostalgic, good sandals and swords and sandals flick.
Yeah, I'm with you. I'm a big fan. This is probably in my top five Harryhausen films, maybe in my top two. You know, it has so many good things going for it. I just love it. I can't gush about it enough, but we won't keep going on. We don't want to bore
everybody. We're not the only people that think this either. You know, I think it's considered, Ray Harryhausen himself considered this his favorite. And even Tom Hanks, sometime in the 80s, I think, 80s or 90s, he's presenting an award. Ray Harryhausen was being inducted into the Oscars technical whatever. And Tom Hanks said, you know, some people say Citizen Kane, some people say Casablanca. I say Jason and the Argonauts is the best movie of all time. So
yeah, that's cool.
That's pretty high praise.
That is high praise. Well, I will recommend that everyone go out to our Instagram and our Facebook at Attack of the 20th Century. We actually have some good fan mail about this movie. Others really love this movie too.
Yeah.
So Marv's Smooth on Instagram says classic with a emoji. I don't know what you call that emoji.
Like the A-OK sign?
A-OK sign. Yeah, there you go. Dead City Drive-In, our friend Chris and his partner, says, probably the most famous of Harryhausen's films. Another one of those movies that I love so much. I have it on Blu-ray. Talos and the skeletons are so iconic. I taught an animation segment for a summer camp and had the kids watch this one. Brings out the kid in all of us.
Yes.
Nat W2312 says, love it. The care and attention to detail, plus the sheer love of stop motion capture, is something CGI can never replicate, no matter how many portals and epic battles they chuck in. Children of the Hydra's Teeth rule.
The Skeleton Army. We didn't even really talk about the Skeleton Army. We didn't really talk about
that. Totally is a high five.
Yeah, that's second billing for me behind Talos as favorite monsters is Skeleton Army.
That scene where the skeletons are like creeping up on Jason and his two men, and then somebody lets out a shriek.
Yeah.
And they all start running at him. There's something about that. It's like, it's funny, but it does kind of
There's
weird
something
you out,
humorous but. About it, but creepy. Yeah.
Another comment, Jip Links has several heart emojis and says, my favorite Ray Harryhausen movie. Like I said, definitely top five at least, maybe top two.
Yeah. What's your top Ray Harryhausen movie?
One of the middle Sinbad movie really partial to.
So if we ever cover that on a podcast episode, the cat is out of the bag.
Cat's out of the bag. All right. For those who were expecting a podcast last week, we do apologize. We had several things going on in our personal lives that kind of got in the way. Life happens sometimes. And
kids.
Kids. Yeah. But anyway, we do have a film next week that we're excited about. We'll tell you about in a minute. But it is not what we announced on Instagram.
Nope.
We did originally announce that we were going to do Theater of Blood with Vincent Price. And we were super excited to do that, especially when we found it for free on Tubi TV like we did with Black Sunday.
Right.
Unfortunately, it was all done in Spanish.
And our Spanish is no bueno.
See, it was very odd. Now, we looked and looked and looked, and we could not find this film unless you were willing to spend, you know, $4 or $5 to rent it. We went ahead and switched it out since we have an Amazon subscription, and a lot of you do too. So what are we watching next week?
Okay, so next week we will be watching the 1987 horror flick, The Monster Squad. It's rated PG-13, and Rotten Tomatoes says it is a fun 80s adventure with a slightly scary twist.
Ooh, I'm excited. A little spoiler here. I've never seen this movie, so.
I have, but it's been so long ago that I barely remember it.
Well, I'm excited to watch it. It's like we're going to be on nearly even footing watching this film, and we'll give you our honest opinions and observations about it next week.
Yeah.
So until then, have a great week.
Enjoy your movies.
And peace out.
Peace out, guys.